You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. And a very good Wednesday hump day morning to you here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Let me tell you what we're going to do today. A lot of stuff going on in the world. And I think most interesting are the events, not in Washington, D.C., but we'll get to that. But the events in Tehran and Iran, where for the first time ever, ISIS has taken their little fight to the Iranians. And to be honest with you, they've taken it to the, you know, holy of holies in the Iranian culture. So stand by for that. Ultimately, that is the fight. And, they all dance around it, but it is the Sunni-Shia thing that they can't live with each other. So, interesting events over, you know, the course of the last 12 hours. Watershed events. I don't know when the last time I was listening to reports and doing a little bit of reading, the last time that somebody struck the Iranians in the Iranian homeland the same way that, you know, that Great Britain, Germany, France, just about any Western nation has been struck, to include the United States. So we'll keep our eyes on developments relative to that. We'll also, the biggest news, the biggest theater this morning is certainly the start of the Senate Intel Committee hearing, and we'll pay attention to that. We'll probably listen to a little bit of that because there's some interesting stuff going on, and so the principals are gathering in Washington, D.C. So let me start the program to make it official. The United States Marine Corps Band gets it going, and then we'll see what's going on in D.C. We'll also have Ben Connable interviewed today. Should have been yesterday, but he'll talk about Iraq. And then I wanted to play for you. Today's Wednesday, so the gunner's being Mother Teresa today. And so in the third hour, you're going to hear some audio from something that we've talked to and I've got some email about, and that is particularly the whole concept between a higher call, the Messerschmitt 109 that doesn't shoot down a B-17 in World War II, the story behind that. So the Marine Corps Band makes it official. Good morning. We can't begin the day without being appropriately motivated. Yeah.
my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
That's right. What? Hold on, you got to hear that again. This is awesome.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
And it's true. Especially his own staff. Oh my God, if you don't have your shit together, that guy's a nightmare. I swear to God, grown men just living in fear. I know a guy who didn't even show up for work the last day. That he was a CG in Iraq. He didn't come to work. He just stayed in his quarters. Yeah, I probably should talk about stuff like that. Yeah, he's killed him. Anyway, we're on the Marine Corps currently. 67 and partly sunny in Quantico, cloudy and 67 at Camp Lejeune. Granbury, Texas, partly sunny and 77. Big Timber, Montana, mostly sunny, 58. 29 Palms, sunny and 76. At the home of Task Force Ripper, cloudy and 62 at Camp Pendleton. Camp Smith, cloudy, dark, 77. Okinawa, cloudy, dark, 81. Fallujah, 107 late in the day. The home of All Marine Radio, 61 degrees under cloudy skies. Headed for 70 today. Red Sox beat the Yankees last night 5-4 in your sports update. Hated that, but it was a good game. High drama at the end. Love that. And you know what? And there's nothing like baseball for high drama because of the meter of the sport, pitch by pitch. It has this, you know, the delivery, the build-up. Swing and a miss. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to keep our eye on making opening, bloviating statements that they don't mean at the Senate Intel hearing. So we'll probably take a little bit about that.
Parents in our 2016 elections, I'm going to have to take at least part of my time to pose some questions during my question time.
What? That just confused me. This hour, I'm going to take part of my question time to pose some questions during question time. Battle Mug. Our sponsor, right here. Don't touch that dial. So we'll look at the stories. We'll keep our eye on Iran. We'll look at the Senate Intel committee hearing, and then Ben Connable will make you smart about Iraq, or he'll confuse you. One of the two. I listened to it again last night, and what the hell, man? Iraq, Syria, Iranian. It's just jumbled bowl of shit. So, but he goes through it with us and makes us smarter nonetheless. And then a higher call. You'll hear from the principals. Hans Stiegler is one of them. So sit back, relax, enjoy the morning. Thanks for being with us as we start our second year. Hua. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All I can say about militarybyowner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life? The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If everybody had an ocean,
it is summer.
Then everybody be serving. Like California, yeah. You'd see them wearing their baggies, Warachi sandals too. A bushy, bushy blonde hairdo, serving USA. You'll catch them surfing at dead.
You know that there's Marine Corps in this, don't you? Trestles. It's in the song. Kent Pendleton. Actually, the Gunner's got a funny surfing song. He's got a funny surfing story. It's hilarious. We were doing a... In fact, I didn't know he was out there. And so we're at Kent Pendleton. We're doing a... there's supposed to be an amphibious landing, and these surfers won't get out of the way. So, and there's campers on the beach. So Mike goes down there and threw them off his beach. Anyway. All right, hold on.
Committee, we are pleased to be here today at your request.
This is Dan Coats, Director of National Intelligence.
Important and perhaps the most important piece of legislation that affects the intelligence community. I'm here with my colleagues. I would like to take the opportunity to explain in some detail Section 702, given this as a public hearing.
Now, this is the hearing is on surveillance powers.
Our efforts to provide transparency in terms of how we protect the privacy and civil liberties of our American citizens needs to be explained. The program needs to be understood, and so I appreciate your patience as I talk through in my opening statement the value of 702 to our intelligence community and to keeping Americans safe. Intelligence collection under Section 702 of FISA amendments has produced and continues to produce significant intelligence that is vital to protect the nation against international terrorism, against cyber threats, weapons proliferators, and other threats. At the same time, Section 702 provides strong protections for the privacy and civil liberties of our citizens. Today, the horrific attacks that recently have occurred in Europe are still at the top of my mind. I was just in Europe days before the first attack in Manchester, followed by other attacks that have subsequently taken place. I was in discussion with my British colleagues through this, as well as colleagues in other European nations, and my sympathies go out to the victims and families of those that have received these heinous attacks, and to the incredible resilience that these communities affected by this violence have shown. Having just returned from Europe less than 3 weeks ago, I'm reminded of why Section 702 is so important to our mission, of not only protecting American lives, but the lives of our friends and allies around the world. And although the many successes enabled by 702 are highly classified, the purpose of the authority is to give the United States intelligence community the upper hand in trying to avert these types of attacks before they transpire, which is why permanent reauthorization of the FISA Amendments Act without further amendment is the intelligence community's top legislative priority. And based on the long history of oversight and transparency of this authority, I would urge the Congress to enact this legislation at the earliest possible date to give our intelligence professionals the consistency they need to maintain our capability. Let me begin today by giving an example of the impact of Section 702 of FISA. It's been cited before, but I think it is worth mentioning again. An NSA FISA Section 02 collection against an email address used by an Al-Qaeda courier in Pakistan revealed communications with an unknown individual located within the United States. The U.S.-based person was urgently seeking advice on how to make explosives. NSA passed this information on to the FBI, which in turn was able to quickly identify the individual as Nasbullah Zazi. And as you know, Zazi and his associates, in fact, had imminent plans to detonate explosives on Manhattan's subway lines. After Zazi and his co-conspirators were arrested, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board stated in its report, and I quote, "Without the initial tip-off about Zazi and his plans, which came about by monitoring an overseas foreigner under Section 702, the subway bombing plot might have succeeded." This is just one example out of many of the impacts this authority has had on the IC's ability to thwart imminent threats and plots against the United States citizens and our friends and allies overseas. Since it was enacted nearly 10 years ago, the FISA Act has been subject to rigorous and constant oversight by all three branches of government. Indeed, we regularly report to the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees of both the House and the Senate how we have implemented the statute, the operational value it has afforded, and the extensive measures we take to ensure that the government's use of these authorities complies with the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Further, over the past few years, we have engaged in an unprecedented amount of public transparency on the use of these authorities. In the interest of transparency, and because this is a public hearing, allow me to provide an overview of the framework for Section 702 and the reasons why the Congress amended FISA in 2008. I will then briefly address why 702 needs to be reauthorized, and finally I will discuss oversight and compliance and how we are ensuring and continue to ensure the rights of U.S. citizens, rights that need to be protected. At the outset, I want to stress three things as a backdrop to everything else that my colleagues and I are presenting today. First, as I mentioned at the outset, Collection Under 702 has produced and continues to produce intelligence that is vital to protect the nation against international terrorism and other threats. Secondly, there are important legal limitations found within Section 702 of FISA, and let me note four of these legal limitations. First, the authorities granted under Section 702 may only be used to target foreign persons located abroad for foreign intelligence purposes. Secondly, they may not be used to target U.S. persons anywhere in the world. Third, they may not be used to target anyone located inside the United States, regardless of their nationality. And fourth, they may not be used to target a foreign person when the intent is to acquire the communications of a U.S. person with whom a foreign person is communicating. This is generally referred to as the prohibition against reverse targeting. The third item I would like to stress is that we are committed to ensuring that the intelligence community's use of 702 is consistent with the law and the protection of the privacy and civil liberties of Americans. And to that end, in the nearly 10 years since Congress enacted the FAA, there have been no instances of intentional violations of Section 702. I'd like to repeat that. In the nearly 10 years since Congress enacted the amendments to the Freedom Act, the act that established FISA, there have been no instances of intentional violations of Section 702. With those points as a backdrop, now let me turn to a discussion of why it became necessary for Congress to enact Section 702.
This is Dan Coats, former senator, currently head of the NSA.
And the basis for this important law. The Foreign Intelligence and Surveillance Act was first passed in 1978, creating a way for the federal government to obtain court orders for electronic surveillance of suspected spies, terrorists, and foreign diplomats located inside the United States. When originally enacting FISA, Congress decided that collection against targets located abroad would generally be outside of their regime, FISA's regime. That decision reflected the fact that people in the United States are protected by the Fourth Amendment, while foreigners located abroad are not. Congress accomplished this in large part by defining electronic surveillance based on the technology of the time. In the 1970s, overseas communication were predominantly carried by satellite. FISA, as passed in 1978, did not require a court order for the collection of these overseas satellite communications. So, for example, if in 1980 NASA intercepted a satellite communication of a foreign terrorist abroad, no court order was required. However, by 2008, technology had changed considerably. First, U.S.-based email services were being used by people all over the world. Second, the overseas communications that in 1978 were typically carried by satellite were now being carried by fiber optic cables, often running through the United States. So to continue the same example, if in 2008 a foreign terrorist was communicating by using a U.S.-based email service, a traditional FISA court order was required to compel a U.S.-based company to help with that collection. Under traditional FISA, a court order can only be obtained on an individual basis by demonstrating to a federal judge that there is probable cause to believe that the target of the proposed surveillance is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. This had become an ever more difficult and extremely resource-intensive process. And therefore, due to these changes in technology, the same resource-intensive legal process was being used to conduct surveillance on terrorists located abroad, who were not protected by the Fourth Amendment, as was being used to conduct surveillance on U.S. persons inside the United States, who are protected by the Fourth Amendment. By enacting 702 in 2008 and renewing it in 2012, both times with significant bipartisan support, Congress corrected this anomaly, restoring the balance of protections established by the original FISA statute. And although I will not go into great detail here regarding the legal framework for FISA Section 702, I will simply note a few key items. First, the statute requires annual certifications by the Attorney General and by the Director of National Intelligence regarding the categories of foreign intelligence that the intelligence community will acquire under this authority. Second, the statute requires targeting procedures that set forth the rules by which the intelligence community ensures that only foreign persons abroad are targeted for collection. Thirdly, the statute requires minimization procedures protecting U.S. persons' information that may be incidentally acquired while targeting foreign persons. And finally, each year, the FISA court reviews this entire package of material to make sure the government's program is consistent with both the statute and with the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. We have publicly released lightly redacted versions of all these documents, including the most recent FISC opinion, to ensure the public has a good understanding of how we use this authority. The government's Section 702 program, as we have said, is subject to rigorous and frequent oversight by all three branches of government. The first line of oversight and compliance is within the agencies themselves, whose offices of general counsel, privacy and civil liberties offices, and inspectors general all have a role in FISA 702 program oversight. The majority of the incidents of noncompliance that are reported to my office and to the Department of Justice are self-reported by the participating agencies. In addition, the Office of the DNI and Department of Justice conduct regular audits focusing on compliance with the targeting procedures as well as on querying of collected data and on dissemination of information under the minimization procedures. Also, we have regular engagements with and extensive reporting to Congress about the FISA 702 program. For example, the Judiciary and Intelligence Committees receive relevant orders of the FISA court in associated pleadings, descriptions and analysis of every compliance incident, and certain statistical information such as the number of intelligence reports in which a known U.S. person was identified. And finally, of course, the FISA court regularly checks our work, both through the annual recertification process and through regular interactions on particular incidents of noncompliance. Members of the FISA court, who are all appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, represent the best of our judicial community. They have vast judicial experience and are committed to the constitutional responsibilities of protecting the privacy of U.S. persons. We are particularly proud of our oversight and compliance track record. The audits of the program conducted by the ODNI and DOJ have shown that unintended error rates are extremely low, substantially less than 1%. Further, and I want to emphasize this, we have never, not once, found an intentional violation of this program. There have been unintended mistakes, but I would note that any system with zero compliance incidents is a broken compliance system because human beings make mistakes. The difference here is that none of these mistakes has been intentional. When we do find unintentional errors in compliance incidents, we ensure that they are reported and corrected. This is an extraordinary record of success for the diligent men and women of the intelligence community who are committed to ensuring that their neighbor's privacy is protected in the course of their national security work. And with that, I'd like to turn to the most recent compliant incident, which resulted in a significant change in how the National Security Agency conducts a portion of its FISA 702 collection. A recent example of the oversight process at work, NASA identified a compliance incident involving queries of U.S. persons' identifiers into Section 702 acquired upstream data. Upstream data refers to when NASA receives communications directly from the Internet with the assistance of companies that maintain these backbone networks. The FISC FISA court was promptly notified and DOJ and ODNI worked with NSA to understand the scope and causes of the problem, as well as to identify potential solutions to prevent the problem from reoccurring. The details of the incident are publicly available, and Admiral Rogers will go or can go into more detail during the question and answer session if you would like. But just allow me briefly to state what happened. NASA identified and researched a compliance issue. NSA, reported that issue to DOJ, ODNI, and ultimately the FISA court. The court delayed its consideration of the 2016 certifications on that basis until the government was able to correct the issue. NSA determined that a possible solution to the compliance problem was to stop conducting one specific type of upstream collection. So ultimately, we decided that the most effective way to address the court's concerns was to stop collecting on this basis. It's called the abouts portion of upstream collection. And by abouts collection, I'm referring to NSA's ability to collect communications where the foreign intelligence target is neither the sender nor the recipient of the communication that's made, but is referenced within the communication itself. The FISA court agreed with our solution and approved the program as a whole on the basis of the NSA proposal. In short, what I'm trying to say here is that a compliance issue was identified, and after a great deal of hard work, the Department of Justice and the intelligence community proposed to the FISA court an effective solution that took the relevant collection costs and compliance benefits into account, and the court agreed with the proposed solution. That is how the process works, and it works well. Before I conclude, I would like to speak briefly about an issue that has been the subject of much public discussion. There have been numerous requests from both Congress and the advocacy community for NSA to attempt to count the number of United States persons whose communications have been incidentally acquired in the course of FISA 702 collection. During my confirmation hearing and in a subsequent hearing before this committee, I committed to sitting down with Admiral Rogers and the subject matter experts in the intelligence community to understand why this has been so difficult. Within my first few weeks on the job, I visited NSA, discussed with Admiral Rogers and his technical people, and followed through on my commitment. What I learned was that the NSA has made They have made extensive efforts. Herculean. All right, I have to turn to. You know what I mean? I mean really tough efforts, all right, to devise a counting strategy that would be accurate and that would respond to the question that was asked. But I also learned that it remains infeasible to generate an exact, accurate, meaningful, and responsive methodology that can count how often a U.S. person's communications may be incidentally collected under 702. I want to be clear here. To determine if communicants are U.S. persons, NSA would be required to conduct significant additional research trying to determine whether individuals who may be of no foreign intelligence interest are U.S. persons. And from my perspective as the Director of National Intelligence, this raises two significant concerns. First, I would be asking trained NSA analysts to conduct intense identity verification research on potential U.S. persons who are not targets of an investigation. From a privacy and civil liberties perspective, I find this unpalatable. Second, those scores of analysis that would have to be shifted from key focus areas such as counterterrorism, counterintelligence, counterproliferation, issues with nations in which, such as North Korea, and Iran, we need continuous and critical intelligence missions. I can't justify such a diversion of critical resources and the mass of critical resources that we would need to try to attempt to reach this, even without the ability to reach a definite number. I can't justify that at a time when we face such a diversity of serious threats. And finally, even if we decided the privacy intrusions were justified, and if I had unlimited staff to tackle this problem, we still do not believe it is possible to come up with an accurate, measurable result. I'm aware that the Senate Intelligence Committee staff will be meeting following this public hearing in a classified session, and Admiral Rogers has instructed his experts to address this issue in greater detail. Before I wrap up my remarks, I want to provide one final example that I have, for the purposes of today's hearing, chosen to declassify, using my authority as the Director of National Intelligence, to further illustrate the value of Section 702. Before rising through the ranks to become at one point the second in command of the self-proclaimed Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, ISIS, Haji Iman was a high school teacher and imam. His transformation from citizen to terrorist caused the U.S. government to offer a $7 million reward for information leading to him. It also made him a top focus of the NSA's counterterrorism efforts. NSA, along with its IC partners, spent over 2 years, from 2014 to 2016, looking for Haji Iman. This search was ultimately successful, primarily because of FISA Section 702. Indeed, based almost exclusively on intelligence activities under Section 702, NSA collected a significant body of foreign intelligence about the activities of Haji Iman and his associates. Beginning with non-Section 702 collection, NSA learned of an individual closely associated with Haji Iman. NSA used collection permitted and authorized under Section 702 to collect intelligence on the close associates of Haji Iman, which allowed NSA to develop a robust body of knowledge concerning the personal network of Haji Iman and his close associates. Over a two-year period, using FISA Section 702 collection and in close collaboration with our IC partners, NSA produced more intelligence on Haji Iman's associates, including their location. NSA and its tactical partners then combined this information, the Section 702 collection, which was continuing, and other intelligence assets to identify the reclusive Haji Iman and track his movements. Ultimately, this collaboration enabled U.S. forces to attempt an apprehension of Haji Iman and two of his associates. On March 24, 2016, during the attempted apprehension operation, shots were fired at the U.S. forces aircraft from Haji Iman's location. U.S. forces returned fire, killing Haji Iman and the other associates at that location. Subsequent Section 702 collection confirmed Haji Iman's death. As you can see from this sensitive example, Section 702 is an extremely valuable intelligence collection tool, and one that is subject to a rigorous, effective oversight program. And therefore, allow me to reiterate my call on behalf of the intelligence community without hesitation, my call for permanent reauthorization of the FISA Amendments Act without further amendment. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your patience, and we would be willing to be open to your questions.
Thank you, Director Coates. The chair would recognize himself now for 5 minutes of questions. In 2012, I mentioned in my opening statement, Director of National Intelligence Jim Clapper and Attorney General Eric Holder wrote a letter to the congressional leadership asking Congress to pass straight reauthorization of FISA. The September 2012 statement of administration policy also urged the same. This would be to Director Coates and A.G. Rosenstein. Has the ODNI or the Department of Justice position changed at all since the time of the February 2012 letter?
No, we strongly support the 2012 letter and request.
We agree 100%.
Great. This is to Admiral Rogers and to Director McKay. Since Congress last authorized this authority in 2012, again, have there been any instances involving a deliberate or intentional compliance violation? Admiral Rogers?
Not that I'm aware of.
Director McCabe?
No, sir.
Admiral Rogers, this is to you.
Sir.
If FISA's 702 statutory authorities were to end or even be diminished, what would be the impact on our national security?
I could not generate the same level of insight that the nation, our friends and allies around the world count on with respect to counterterrorism, counterproliferation. I could not, for example, be able to recreate the insights on the Russian efforts to influence the 2016 election cycle. Without 702, we could not have produced that level of insight.
This is a jump ball. April 26, 2017, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, commonly known as FISC, held that Section 02 certifications, including its targeting and minimization procedures, are lawful both under FISA statute and the Fourth Amendment. As former Director Comey testified last month, the only reason our laws even require the certification to cover, and I quote, these non-Americans who aren't in our country, is because their communications transiting U.S.-based networks and systems, yet others have suggested imposing a Fourth Amendment warrant requirement on foreigners who are located outside of the United States. This is really NSA and Justice. Would imposing such a warrant requirement impact our national security tools to protect America?
He's referring to me. I'll be happy to take the ball. Yes, it would, Senator. I think what's important to recognize is that in the absence of Section 702, the Department of Justice, the intelligence community, in every case in which we wanted to obtain foreign intelligence information to collect against a particular target, we'd be required to obtain a court order. It would need to be supported by probable cause. The consequence of that is, number one, it'd be very time-consuming because these are very thorough investigations and we produce very lengthy documents. In fact, Director McCabe and I spent a fair amount of our time every morning reviewing a stack of documents with our career agents and prosecutors in which they have determined that it's appropriate to seek those orders. So it'd be time-consuming. It would require a significant commitment of resources. And in addition to that, it would require a showing of probable cause. And as you know, the probable cause showing, which is required under the Constitution, in circumstances in which privacy interests of Americans are at stake and it's required by the Fourth Amendment, that's a relatively higher threshold than we require for foreign intelligence information. And so we think it's important, Senator, that we not apply that Fourth Amendment constitutional standard to foreigners who are not in the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenstein. Admiral Rogers, this is to you. There's a lot of news reporting, much of it inaccurate, that characterizes Section 702 as a means of targeting U.S. persons. We know that targeting U.S. persons is prohibited, as is what is termed reverse targeting. Could you explain and clarify the reverse targeting prohibition, and what does it prevent the IC from targeting and collecting?
So reverse targeting is designed to preclude our ability to bypass the law. What do I mean by that? The law is expressly designed to ensure that we are not using this legal framework as a capability to target U.S. persons. Reverse targeting is the following scenario. Say we're interested in generating insight on U.S. person A. We know that we can't get a Title I, we can't get a FISA warrant. So under the idea of reverse targeting, the theory would be, well, why don't you just target a foreign entity that U.S. person talks to, and then you'll get all the insights you want on the U.S. person, but you'll have bypassed the court process, you'll have bypassed the entire legal structure. 702 specifically reminds us we cannot do that. We cannot use 702 as a vehicle to bypass other laws or to target U.S. persons.
Can you, last question, can you please clarify for members and for the public what's meant by incidental collection?
Incidental collection, and the statute itself, if you read the law, the statute acknowledges that in the execution of this framework, we will encounter U.S. persons. We call that incidental collection. That happens under two scenarios. Number one, which is about 90% of the time, We are monitoring two foreign individuals, and those foreign entities talk about or reference a U.S. person. The second scenario that we do, that we encounter, what we call incidental collection, is we are targeting a valid foreign individual. And that valid foreign individual, a foreign intelligence target, ends up having a conversation with a U.S. person. That's not the target of our collection. It's not why we are monitoring it in the first place. We're interested in that foreign target. That happens of the times we have incidental collection. That scenario happens about 10% of the time.
And were that incidental collection to happen, you have a procedure in place in both instances to minimize that.
We do. The law. The law specifically gives us a set of processes that we have to follow. So if we do encounter a U.S. person incidentally in the course of our collection, we ask ourselves several questions. Number one, are we looking at potential criminal activity? If we do that, we have a requirement to report or to inform the Department of Justice and the FBI, and they make the determination if it's illegal or not. We are an intelligence organization, not a law enforcement organization. The second question we ask ourselves, is there anything in this conversation that would lead us to believe that we're talking about harm to individuals? In that case, we do report. If we think we're dealing with something that is criminal or there's harm to individuals, we report it. Other than that, unless there is a valid intelligence purpose, depending on the authority, in the case of 702, we specifically purge the data. We remove it. We don't put it into our holdings. If we don't assess that there's intelligence value and it's a U.S. person, we have to purge the data.
Thank you for that, Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I indicated, I've got some questions on another matter, and Director Coates and Admiral Rogers, they're mostly going to be directed at you gentlemen, and thank you for your testimony this morning. And we all know now that in March, then-Director Comey testified about the existence of an ongoing FBI investigation into links between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. And there are reports out in the press that the president separately appealed to you, Admiral Rogers, and to you, Director Coates, to downplay the Russia investigation. And now we've got additional reports, and we want to give you a chance to confirm or deny these, that the president separately addressed you, Director Coates, and asked you to, in effect, intervene with Director Comey, again, to downplay the FBI investigation. Admiral Rogers, you draw the short straw. I'm going to start with you. Before we get to the substance of whether this call or request was made, you've had a very distinguished career, close to 40 years. In your experience, would it be in any way typical for a president to ask questions or bring up an ongoing FBI investigation, particularly if that investigation concerns associates and individuals that might be associated with the president's campaign or his activities?
I am not going to talk about theoreticals. I am not going to discuss the specifics of any interaction or conversations I may or
can
may
you,
not
can you
if I could finish
yes,
it, please, that I may or may not have had with the president of the United States, but I will make the following comment. In the 3+ years that I have been the director of the National Security Agency, to the best of my recollection, I have never been directed to do anything I believe to be illegal, immoral, unethical, or inappropriate. And to the best of my recollection, during that same period of service, I do not recall ever feeling pressured to do so.
But had in your course prior to the incident that we're going to discuss, was it in any regular course where a president would ask you to comment or intervene in any ongoing FBI investigation? Not talking about this circumstance, but
sir,
any prior experience?
I'm not going to talk about theoreticals today.
Well, let me ask you specifically, did the president, the reports that are out there, ask you in any way, shape, or form to back off or downplay the Russian investigation?
I'm not going to discuss the specifics of conversations with the president of the United States, but I stand by the comment I just made to you, sir.
Do you feel that those conversations were classified? We know that there was an ongoing FBI investigation.
Yes, sir.
Or press reports.
Yes, sir.
I understand your answer. I'm disappointed with that answer, but I may indicate, and I told you I was going to bring this up.
Sir.
We have facts that there were other individuals that were aware of the call that was made to you, aware of the substance of that call, and that there was a memo prepared because of concerns about that call. Will you comment at all?
I stand by the comments that I have made to you today, sir.
So you will not confirm or deny the existence of a memo?
I stand by the comments I have made to you today, sir.
I think it will be essential, Mr. Chairman, that that other individual who's served our country as well with great distinction, who's no longer a member of the administration, has a chance to relay his version of those facts. Again, I understand your position, but I hope you'll also understand the enormous need for the American public to know. You've got the administration saying there's no there. We have these reports, and yet we can't get confirmation. I want to go to you, Director Coates. When you appeared before SASC, you said, and I quote,
interesting theater going on right now at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing.
What I know and what I don't know. I have great respect for you. You served on this committee. I remember as well when we confirmed you, and I was proud to support your confirmation. You said that you would cooperate with this committee in any aspects that we request of the Russia investigation. We now have press reports, and you can lay them to rest if they're not true. But we have press reports of not once, but twice, that the President of the United States asked you to either downplay the Russia investigation or to directly intervene with Director Comey. Can you set the record straight about what happened or didn't happen?
Well, Senator, as I responded to a similar question during my confirmation and in a second hearing before the committee, I do not feel it's appropriate for me to, in a public session in which confidential conversations between the President and myself, I don't believe it's appropriate for me to address that in a public session.
Gentlemen, I understand.
I stated that before. I thought you also said
at SASC, if brought before the investigative committee, you would, quote, certainly provide them with what I know and what I don't know. We are before that investigative committee.
Well, I stand by my previous statement that we are in a public session here, and I do not feel that it's appropriate for me to address confidential information. Most of the information I've shared with the President obviously is directed toward intelligence matters during our Oval briefings every morning at the White House, or most mornings when both the President and I'm in town. But for intelligence-related matters or any other matters that have been discussed, it is my belief that it's inappropriate for me to share that with the public.
Gentlemen, I respect all of your service, and I understand and respect your commitment to the administration you're serving. We will have to bring forward that other individual about whether the existence of the memo that may document some of the facts that took place in the conversation between the President and Admiral Rogers. But I would only ask as we go forward, this will be my final comment, Mr. Chairman, that we also have to weigh in here the public's absolute need to know. They're wondering what's going on. They're wondering what type of activities. We see this pattern that, without confirmation or denial, appears that the President, not once, not twice, but we will hear from Director Comey tomorrow, this pattern where the President seems to want to interfere or downplay or halt the ongoing investigation, not only that the Justice Department is taking on, but this committee is taking on. And I hope as we move forward on this, you'll realize the importance that the American public deserves to get the answers to these questions. Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, Senator, I would like to respond to that if I could. First of all, I told you and I committed to the committee that I would be available to testify before the committee. I don't think this is the appropriate venue to do this in, given that this is an open hearing and a lot of confidential information relative to intelligence or other matters. I just don't feel it's appropriate for me to do that in this situation. And then secondly, when I was asked yesterday to respond to a piece that I was told was going to be written and printed in the Washington Post this morning, my response to that was, in my time of service, which is interacting with the President of the United States or anybody in his administration, I have never been pressured. I have never felt pressure to intervene or interfere in any way and shaping intelligence in a political way or in relationship to an ongoing investigation.
All I'd say, Director Coates, is there was a chance here to late arrest some of these press reports. If the president is asking you to intervene or downplay, you may not have felt pressure, but if he's even asking, to me that is a very relevant piece of information. And again, at least in terms of the conversation with Admiral Rogers, I think we will get at least some another individual's version. But at some point, these facts have to come out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Risch.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Director Coates and Admiral Rogers, for your testimony. And with all due respect to my colleague from Virginia, I think you have cleared up substantially your direct testimony that you have never been pressured by anyone, including the President of the United States, to do something illegal, immoral, or anything else. Thank you for that. Let's go back to Section 702, which is what this hearing was supposed to be all about. It's becoming patently obvious, I think, that those of us...
Interesting theater if you're listening that you just heard. And that was this, if you're paying attention. And I think it's interesting for us. Let me just comment here, and then we'll go back to the hearing for a minute. It's interesting for us who've held clearances. What you have is this political drama. You've heard the discussion of 702 FISA, and how does that information seep into the public realm? It's political appointees. You can hear these guys are professionals. They won't go where they don't want to go. And it's very interesting watching when they look at them straight in the face. Admiral Rogers looked at Senator Warren straight in the face, and he said, I won't answer those questions. I will say this. And he said it exclusively. I've never felt pressured. And then you just heard former Senator Coates, now Director Coates, say exactly the same thing. So all of this stuff that's been beaten and leaked and all of that into the media, I would say would be tantamount to somebody's being investigated and you're having a discussion about it as a leader with somebody. And it happens all the time. But you're not asking them to do anything illegal. Maybe you're saying, hey, he's a great guy. I hope this thing all works out well, and you're having a conversation with it. There's a difference. I think that goes on, people going to bat for each other. And I think it goes on whenever there's an investigation. One of the things you'd see happen is so-and-so is being investigated for this. What you see is the people of character and with reputations who know this person. And sometimes they don't know anybody like that, but just say you were well connected and you'd done good work and then somehow you got in the crosshairs or something. Those people pick up the phone. They call their friends who might be part of the investigation and say, hey, what's going on? Hey, just so you know, he's a great guy. I've worked with him for 6 years, blah, 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 and whatnot. Hey, I appreciate it. Not that it changes the outcome, but so again, the way that's all characterized in the media, and again, The truth. What is the truth? And so it's very interesting to hear these gentlemen talk today. So we're going to go back to that. I find it interesting. You may not. So more of that right now.
In many cases are good, but in some cases lack the ability that we have. And so this ability to share information with them that helps keep their people safe also is highly valued by them. But I don't think we should take for granted that just because Europe has been the recent target of these attacks, that the United States is safe from that. We know through intelligence that there's plotting going on, and we know that there's lone wolf issues and individuals that are taking instructions from ISIS through social media, or that for whatever reason are copycatting what is happening. And so that threat exists here also. And then let me lastly say that the nations I've talked to, many of which have been extremely concerned about violating privacy rights, have initiated new procedures and legislation and mandates relative to giving the intelligence agencies better collection because they think it, they need it to protect their citizens.
Thank you very much. In just a few seconds that I've got left, Mr. Rosenstein, could you tell me, please, we get a lot of pushback from the privacy people. And we've now heard testimony that there's been no intentional violation over the 10 years. Could you tell the American people what's in store for someone who these guys catch intentionally misusing 702, since you're the highest ranking member of the Department of Justice here?
Yes, Senator. Well, I can assure you, Senator, that in the Department of Justice, we treat with great seriousness any allegations of violations regarding classified information. So if there were a credible allegation that someone had willfully violated Section 702 in a way that was in violation of a criminal law, we would investigate that case, and if prosecution were justified, we would prosecute it. I know Director McCabe shares with me that commitment. We recognize that we have an obligation to the American people to make sure that these authorities are used appropriately and responsibly.
This is Rod Rosenstein, who's the Deputy Attorney General, but since the Attorney General has recused himself for much of that, he's there.
Your commitment and the Department of Justice's commitment to the American people.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenstein.
Thank you, Mr. Feinstein.
Thanks. thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments on Section 702. It's a program that I support. It's a program that I believe has worked well. It's a big program. It's an important one. It is a content collection program involving both Internet and phone communications. So it can raise concerns about privacy and civil liberties. In the year 2016, there were 106,469 authorized targets out of 3 billion Internet users. That's the ratio. The question of unmasking has been raised. It's my understanding that 1,939 U.S. person identities were unmasked in 2016 based on collection that occurred under Section 702. So my question is going to be the following, and I'll ask it all together, and hopefully you'll answer it. I would like a description of the certification process and the use of an amicus. I would like your response to the fact that the question, the program sunsets after 5 years, about raising that sunset versus no sunset because of the privacy concerns. It's my belief there should be a sunset. And the use of an amicus, which is currently used as part of the certification process, and whether that should be continued and formalized. So, Admiral, it's programs under your auspices.
If I could, DOJ is going to be smarter on the amicus piece, please. Will you take that piece and I'll...
Jen, I'm not sure I am smarter on the amicus piece, Senator. I can tell you this, though, that... with regard to the question of unmasking, and this is actually primarily a question not for the department. The determination is made by the intelligence agencies. If there is a situation where a foreign person has been communicating about an American person and a decision is made whether or not the identity of that American person is necessary in order for that intelligence to be properly used, I think what's important for people to recognize, Senator, is that's an internal issue. That is, that unmasking is done internally, you know, within the cloak of confidentiality within the intelligence community. That's a different issue from leaks. In other words, if somebody's identity is disclosed internally because it's relevant for intelligence purposes, because that's the goal of this collection, is to understand...
Mr. Rosenstein, let me just tell you, I just listened to somebody who should have known better talking about unmasking in a political sense, that it's done politically. And that, of course, is not the case. And so what I'm looking for is the definition of how this is done and under what circumstances.
And I think, Senator, that because that's really a decision made by the IC, the Intelligence Committee, not by the Department, it would be appropriate for them to respond to that.
I can do that. So with respect to unmasking, the following criteria apply. First, for the National Security Agency, we define in writing who has the authority to unmask a U.S. person identity. That is 20 individuals in 12 different positions. I am one of the 20 in one of those 12 positions, the director. Secondly, we outline in writing what are the criteria that will be applied to a request to unmask. In a report, and again, part of our process under 702 to protect the identity of U.S. persons as part of our minimization procedures, when we think we need to reference a U.S. person in a report, we will not use a name. We will not use an identity. We say U.S. person 1, U.S. person 2, U.S. person 3. That report is then promulgated. Some of the recipients of that report will sometimes come back to us and say, I'm trying to understand what I am reading. Could you help me understand who is person 1 or who is person 2, etc.? We apply two criteria in response to their request. Number one, you must make the request in writing. Number two, the request must be made on the basis of your official duties, not the fact that you just find this report really interesting and you're just curious. It has to tangibly tie to your job. And then finally, I said too, but there's a third criterion, and that is the basis of the request must be that you need this identity to understand the intelligence you're reading. We apply those three criteria. We do it in writing, and one of those 20 individuals then agrees or disagrees. And if we unmask, we go back to that entity who requested it, not every individual who received the report, but that one entity who asked for us. We then provide them the U.S. identity, and we also remind them the classification of this report and the sensitivity of that identity remains in place. By revealing this U.S. person to you, we are doing it to help you understand the intelligence, not so that you can use that knowledge indiscriminately. It must remain appropriately protected.
Thank you.
And, Senator, if I could just add something to that. Given the nature of this issue, and it's a legitimate question that you've asked, I've talked with my colleagues at NSA and CIA, FBI, and so forth, and suggesting that we might ask our civil liberties and privacy protection agencies to take a look at this, to see if they're, Ed Rogers laid out the procedures. Are these the right procedures? Should we be doing something different? Would they have recommendations that better protected people from misuse of this? And they've all agreed to do that. So I think it's a legitimate issue to follow up on. I've talked to the agency heads about doing so, and they're willing to do it.
And if I could, I also have an internal review that I have directed. Given all the attention, given the focus, let's step back, let's reassess it, and let's ask ourselves, is there anything that would suggest we need to do something different in the process?
Good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to more thoroughly answer the first question the Senator asked, which is, Senator Feinstein, my understanding is that an amicus was used in 2015. And that decision was made by the court. It's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which has the statutory authority, if the court believes it's appropriate in a particular case, to appoint an amicus. So my understanding is that that was done in 2015. Thank you.
Well, would you feel it would be helpful to make it a part of the regular certification process?
Well, my understanding, Senator, is that the statute permits the court to do it if the court believes it's appropriate. So I believe the court has that authority, and I'd leave it to the judges to decide when it's appropriate to exercise that.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr.
Senator Rubio.
Thank you all for being here. I understand fully the need of the President of the United States to be able to have conversations with members of the intelligence community that are protected, particularly in a classified setting. I also understand that the ability of this community to function depends both on its credibility, that its work that it's doing is in the national security interest of the United States, and also the importance of its independence, that it is not an extension of politics, no matter which administration is at play. In the absence of either one of those two things, impacts everything we do, including this debate we're having here today. And the challenge that we have now is that while the folks here with us this morning are constrained in what they can say, there are people that apparently work for you that are not and are constantly speaking to the media about things and saying things. And it puts the Congress in a very difficult position because the issue of oversight on both your independence and on your credibility falls on us. And And I actually think if what is being said to the media is untrue, then it is unfair to the President of the United States. And if it is, then it is that if it is true, that it is something the American people deserve to know, and we as an oversight committee need to know in order to conduct our job. And so my questions are geared to Director Coates and Admiral Rogers. You have testified that you have never felt pressured or threatened by the President or by anyone to influence any ongoing investigation by the FBI. Are you prepared to say that you have never felt that you've never been asked by the President or the White House to influence an ongoing investigation?
Well, Senator, I just hate to keep repeating this, but I'm going to do it. I'm willing to come before the committee and tell you what I know and what I don't know. What I'm not willing to do is to share what I think is confidential information that ought to be protected in an open hearing. And so I'm not prepared to answer your question today.
Director Coates, I would just say, with incredible respect that I have for you, I am not asking for classified information. I am asking whether or not you have ever been asked by anyone to influence an ongoing investigation.
I understand, but I'm just not going to go down that road in a public forum. And I also was asked the question if the special prosecutor called upon me to meet with him to ask his questions, I said I would be willing to do that.
I likewise stand by my previous comment.
Okay, well then, in the interest of time, let me ask both of you, has anyone ever asked you, now or in the past, this administration or any administration, to issue a statement that you knew to be false?
For me, I stand by my previous statement. I've never been directed to do anything in the course of my 3-plus years as the director of the National Security Agency that I felt to be inappropriate, nor have I felt pressure to do so.
Have you ever been asked to say something that isn't true?
I stand by my previous statement, sir.
Director Coates?
I do likewise.
Well, let me ask this of everyone on this panel. Is anyone aware of any effort by anyone in the White House or elsewhere to seek advice on how to influence any investigation?
My answer is absolutely no, Senator.
No one has anything to add to that.
I don't understand the question.
The question is, are you aware of any efforts by anyone in the White House or the executive branch looking for advice from other members of the intelligence community about how to potentially influence an investigation?
Are you talking about me? No.
No.
Okay. Who wants to answer? I'm sorry.
We're going to take a quick break and then come back. Let me just tell you what's interesting. In listening to this, again, it's the Senate Intelligence Committee, and it's the hearing on the FISA or civilian intelligence gathering that's aimed at outside non-citizens. And in the course of that, intelligence is picked up from un-American citizens, how that's handled, how people are unmasked and whatnot. But again, as this story is going out, to me, and the major story of this hearing this morning is this. You've had NSA Director Rogers, right, and Intelligence Director Coates both say they've never felt any pressure from the White House. Okay? That's what they've said in open session. Here's what the Washington Post just put out. NSA Director Rogers and Intelligence Director Coates say they will not discuss specifics of private conversations with Trump. That's the headline that just went out. And that's my point about the truth. Right? The Washington Post is a powerful newspaper. What their news editors decided that they would put at the top of this story as this news kind of and this theater unfolds in front of us this morning is huge. But it also goes to, if you're listening, what is the elephant in the room that they said they talked about? So, and again, I'm not looking to vindicate the president. I'm just saying, as a news person, what's the story? We're going to take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. The theater. It reminds me a little bit, well, I won't say it, but a little bit of Watergate stuff. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug. home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum, it's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue here. Dan Coates is talking right here. He's the Director of National Intelligence.
Working to produce a relevant metric. Now, let me go to my other question.
But we were not able to do it, to achieve it. Working to do it is different than doing it.
You told the American people that even a statistical sample would be jeopardizing America's national security. That is inaccurate and, I think, detrimental to the cause of ensuring we have both security and liberty. Now, here's my other question. We are trying to sort out who are the targets.
Apparently not.
Who are the targets of a 702?
Interesting. This is getting testy. Did you hear that? Can we respond? This is a senator by the name of Wyden. He's a Democrat.
And I think it would be very helpful if you would tell us who, in fact,
are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military?
We want to go after serious foreign threats, but we don't know as of now, with Director Comey having given three different answers, who the targets are, Mr. Director.
Well, I can't speak for Director Palmer, Director Clapper. Targets, as I understand, are non-U.S. persons, foreign individuals are the targets. In terms, 702 is directed and prohibited from directing targets on U.S. persons.
My time is up. I will tell you, Director Comey gave three answers. He finally said I could be wrong, but I don't think so. I think it's confined to counterterrorism, to espionage, and finally he said he didn't think a diplomat could be targeted. So we need you all, in addition to protecting the liberties of the American people, to tell us who the targets are. Thank
well,
you,
I would like to respond to that by saying some of those targets are classified, highly classified.
I understand that.
Some of those targets, by revealing those names of those targets, release the methods that we use, and then it's turned against us, and could cost the lives or put some of our agents in
Director
significant...
Director Comey listed a number of targets, which is why there's confusion. He said that on the record. We need you to tell us on the record as well, consistent with protecting sources and methods.
Senator Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Coates, first let me thank you for a very cogent explanation of Section 702 and the fact that it cannot be used to target any person located in the United States, whether or not that person is an American. I think there's a lot of confusion about Section 702, and I appreciate your clear explanation this morning. I have a question for each of you that I would like to ask, and I want to start with Admiral Rogers. Admiral Rogers, did anyone at the White House direct you on how to respond today or to were there discussions of executive privilege?
Have I asked the White House, is it their intent to invoke executive privilege? Yes. The answer I gave you today reflects my answer. No one else's.
What were you talking about? Director Coates.
My answer is exactly the same.
Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein.
I have not had any communications with the White House about invoking executive privilege today.
Director McKay.
I have not had any conversations with the White House about executive privilege today either.
Admiral Rogers, in January, the FBI, the CIA, and NSA jointly issued an Intelligence Committee assessment on Russian involvement in the presidential elections. You've testified today that the IC relied in part on 702 authorities to support its conclusion that the Russians were involved in trying to influence the 2016 elections. Can you provide us with an update on NSA's further work in this area?
In terms of the Russian efforts, largely?
Yes,
ma'am. We continue to focus analytic and collection effort trying to generate insights as to what the Russians and others are doing, particularly with respect to efforts against U.S. infrastructure, U.S. processes like elections. We continue to generate insights on a regular basis. If my memory is right, I testified before the CISI. We did the open threat assessment, and in that hearing, which I think was the 11th of May, I reiterated we continue to see this similar activity that we identified and highlighted in the January report. Those trends continue. Much of that activity continues.
It's my understanding that President Obama requested the report that was issued in January. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. He asked for a consolidated single input from the IC as to the question, did the Russians or did they not attempt to influence the U.S. election process?
So could you explain the difference between the requests from President Obama for that unclassified assessment and the allegations that President Trump requested that you publicly report on whether or not there was any intelligence that concerning collusion between the Russians and the members of the Trump campaign, President Trump's campaign?
So I apologize. I guess I'm confused by the question. Again, I'm not going to comment on any interactions with the president. I just don't feel that is appropriate. As I previously testified, I stand by that report.
Let me ask a broader question that I truly am trying to get a handle on, and that is, how does the intelligence community reach a decision on whether or not to comply with a request that comes from the President of the United States? Obviously, you report to the President of the United States, and I'm interested in what process you go through to decide whether or not to undertake a task that's been assigned by the president, by any president.
So off the top of my head, I would say we comply unless we have reason to believe that we are being directed to do something that is illegal, immoral, or unethical.
Thank you.
In which case, we will not execute that.
Senator Heinrich.
Director McCabe, did Director Comey ever share details of his conversations with the president with you? In particular, did Director Comey say that the president had asked for his loyalty?
Sir, I'm not going to comment on conversations the director may have had with the president. I know he's here to testify in front of you tomorrow. You'll have an opportunity to ask him those things.
I'm asking you, did you have that conversation with Director Comey?
And I've responded that I'm not going to comment on those conversations.
Why not?
Because for two reasons. First, as I mentioned, I'm not in a position to talk about conversations that Director Comey may or may not have had with the president.
I'm not asking you that. I'm asking about conversations that you had with Director Comey.
And I think that those matters also begin to fall within the scope of issues being investigated by the special counsel, and it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment on those today.
So you're not invoking executive privilege, and obviously it's not classified. This is the Oversight Committee. Why would it not be appropriate for you to share that conversation with us?
I think I'll let Director Comey speak for himself tomorrow in front of this committee.
We certainly look forward to that, but I think your unwillingness to share that conversation is an issue. Director Coates, you've said as well that it would be inappropriate to answer a simple question about whether the president asked for your assistance in blunting the Russia investigation. I don't care how you felt. I'm not asking whether you felt pressured. I'm simply asking, did that conversation occur?
And once again, Senator, I will say that I do believe it's inappropriate for me to discuss that in an open session.
You realize, and obviously this is not releasing any classified information, but you realize how simple it would simply be to say, no, that never happened. Why is it inappropriate, Director Coates?
I think conversations between the president and myself are, for the most part...
You seem to apply that standard selectively.
No, I'm not applying it selectively. I'm just saying I don't think it's appropriate.
You can clear an awful lot up by simply saying that never happened.
I do not share with the general public conversations that I have with the president or... many of my colleagues within the administration that I believe are should not be shared.
Well, I think your unwillingness to answer a very basic question speaks volumes.
It's not a matter of unwillingness,
Mr. Rosen.
It's a matter of how I share it and whom I share it to. And when there are ongoing investigations, I think it's inappropriate to.
So you don't think the American people deserve to know the answer to that question?
I think the investigations will determine that.
You're part of the investigation. Mr. Rosenstein, did you know when you wrote the memo that was used as the primary justification for firing Director Comey that the administration would be using it as the primary justification?
Senator, as I know you're aware.
What's incredible is, and now we're beyond the 702 port, right? This is all politics right now. It's all theater.
The order appointing the special counsel is in the public record. The press release I issued accompanying that order is in the public record, and a written version of the statement that I delivered to...
Were you aware that it would be the primary justification for his firing?
Pardon me, Senator. 100 United States senators and 435 congressmen is in the public record. I answered many questions in the closed briefings of the 100 senators.
But you're not answering this question.
And as I explained in those briefings, Senator, I support Mr. McCabe on this. We have a special counsel who is investigating now responsible for the Russian...
At this point, you filibuster better than most of my colleagues. So I'm going to move on to another question and say that given...
What a disrespectful asshole.
That his firing was in response to investigations into Russia, which he made very clear in Lester Holt's interviews. You've talked with both the president and the attorney general about this firing. In light of Mr. Sessions' recusal, what role did the attorney general play in that firing? And was it appropriate for him to write the letter that he wrote in this case?
I'm not trying to filibuster, Senator. I think I only took about 30 seconds, but I am not going to comment on that matter. I'm going to leave it to Special Counsel Mueller to determine whether that is within the scope of his investigation, and I believe that's appropriate for Mr. McCabe and me to do that.
Okay, so you can't comment on recusal and what's in and inside and outside the scope of that recusal.
Mr. Chairman, we ought to let the witness answer the question.
Second the motion. So, I'm sorry, your specific question is what's in the recusal. And my understanding is the recusal you're referring to is also in the public record, and I believe it speaks for itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Blunt.
Director McCabe, on May the 11th, when you were before this committee, you said that there has been no effort to impede the Russian investigation. Is that still your position?
It is, but let me clarify, Senator. I think you're referring to the exchange that I had with Senator Rubio. And my understanding, at least my intention in providing that answer, was whether or not the firing of Director Comey had had a negative impact on our investigation. And my response was then and is now that the FBI investigated and continues to investigate, and now, of course, under the rubric of the special counsel, the Russia investigation in a appropriate and unimpeded way before Director Comey was fired and since he's been gone.
Well, I think as I recall that conversation, it was a discussion about whether there were plenty of resources, whether the funding was adequate, and what you were reported to have said. I haven't looked at the exact transcript, but I have looked at the news article, was that you were aware of no effort to impede the Russian investigation.
We did talk about resource issues and whether or not we had asked for additional resources to pursue the investigation. And I believe my response at the time was we had not asked for additional resources and that we had adequate resources to pursue the investigation. That was true then, is still true today.
And you would characterize your quote as no effort to impede the Russian investigation as still accurate?
That's correct.
On the 702 issue, when the FBI wants to follow up on or pursue a U.S. person in or outside the United States, what court do you go to get that to happen? Do you go to the FISA court as well?
If we are seeking collection under 702?
No, how do you relate to 702? Do you ever seek collection under 702?
Sure, yes we do. So let me step back just a minute. So of course, when the FBI seeks electronic surveillance collection on a U.S. person, we go to the FISA court and get a Title I FISA order to do so. If we have an open, full investigation on a foreign person in a foreign place, and the collection is for the purpose of collecting foreign intelligence, we can nominate that person or that, as we refer to it internally, the selector, whether it's an email address or that sort of thing. We can nominate that for 702 coverage. We convey that nomination to the NSA, and they pursue the coverage under their authority.
But you would be the person that would pursue coverage for a U.S. person either here or outside the United States.
That's correct, Senator. We are
the FBI.
We are the U.S. person agency. That's right.
And Admiral Rogers, Senator Feinstein mentioned that last year 1,139 U.S. persons were, the phrase we're using now, unmasked for some purpose. Is that a number you agree with?
It's in the 2016 ODNI-generated transparency report. From memory, the number is actually 1,934, from memory.
I misheard, but 1,900. What would the number have been in 2015?
To be honest, I don't know. I'd have to take that one for the record. I do know that we didn't start with the transparency commitment that we made partnering with the DNI, we didn't start that until the latter end of 2015. So the 2015 data that's been published as a matter of public record is a subset of the entire calendar year. 2016 is the first calendar year where we have published all the data for the entire
Director
year.
Director Coates, do you have any information on that?
Well, I've seen the number. I don't recall what it was, and I just asked my staff.
I guess what I'm asking, and you can take this for the record, is was there an increase in 2016? Did you have significantly more requests based on your subset in 15 happen in 16 than you had had.
I don't know off the top of my head. We'll take it for the record, but I will say this. 702 collection has continued. The amount of total collection has increased generally every year. It's more and more impactful for us. It generates more and more value.
And when you have, when 702 generates information that would indicate there was a U.S. person involved in criminal activity, what do you do with that information?
If we become, we report it to either to DOJ and the FBI, because we're not a criminal organization.
And what do you do if you get that information at DOJ, Mr. Rosenstein? Information from a 702 collection that clearly indicates there's a crime involving a U.S. person.
I hesitate only because that's actually an FBI issue, so I would refer to Mr. McCabe.
Mr. McCabe.
Sure. So we take that referral, and if that's a U.S. person, we begin to build an investigation aiming towards Title I FISA collection.
With adequate protections for U.S. persons and that entire chain of transmission of material.
That's right.
Thank you, Chairman.
Senator King.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First on 702, like Senator Feinstein, I want to express my support for this important tool for our intelligence agencies. I do have a concern, which we can discuss perhaps in closed session, about the process by which American names which are incidentally collected are then queried. I'm concerned by the distinction between query and search and where we run into the Fourth Amendment. It strikes me as bootstrapping to say we collected it legally under 702, and then we can go and look at these American persons. And I believe that the Fourth Amendment imposes a warrant requirement in between that step, which is not present in the present process. We can discuss that at greater length. Mr. McCabe, I'm puzzled by your refusal to answer Senator Heinrich's question about a conversation you may have had with Director Comey. What's the basis of your refusal to answer that question?
Sir, as I stated, I think first, I can't sit here and tell you whether or not that those conversations that you're referring to.
Why not? Do you not remember them?
No, I'm sorry, sir. I don't know whether conversations along the lines that you've described fall within the purview of what the special counsel is now investigating.
Is there some prohibition in the law that I'm not familiar with that you can't discuss an item and that you've been asked directly a question?
It would not be appropriate for me, sir, to discuss issues that are potentially within the purview of the special counsel's investigation.
And that's the basis of your refusal to answer this question?
Yes, sir. And that, and knowing, of course, that Director Comey will be sitting
behind the table. So it's your position that the special counsel is entitled to ask you questions about this, but not an oversight committee of the United States Congress?
It is my position that I have to be particularly careful about not stepping into the special counsel's lane, as they have now been authorized.
I don't understand why the special counsel's lane takes precedence over the lane of the United States Congress and an investigative and oversight committee. Can you explain that distinction? Why does the special counsel get deference and not this committee?
Sir, I'd be happy
to... Is there some legal basis for that distinction?
I would be happy to take that matter back to discuss it more fully with my general counsel and with the department, but right now that's the...
On the record, I would like a legal justification for your refusal to answer the question today, because I think it's a straightforward question. Mm-hmm. It's not involving discussions with the president. It's involving discussions with Mr. Comey. The gentleman, Mr. Director Coates and Admiral Rogers... I think you testified, Admiral Rogers, that you did discuss today's testimony with someone in the White House.
I said I asked, did the White House intend to evoke executive privileges associated with any interactions between myself and the President of the United States?
And what was the answer to that question?
To be honest, I didn't get a definitive answer, and both myself and the DNI are still talking.
So then I'll ask both of you the same question. Why are you not answering these questions? Is there an invocation by the President of the United States of executive privilege? Is there or not?
Not that I'm aware of.
Then why are you not answering
our
question?
Because I feel it is inappropriate, Senator.
What you feel isn't relevant, Admiral. What you feel isn't the answer. The answer is, why are you not answering the questions? Is it an invocation of executive privilege? If there is, then let's know about it. If there isn't, answer the questions.
I stand by the comments I've made. I'm not interested in repeating myself, sir. And I don't mean that in a contentious way.
Well, I do mean it in a contentious way. I don't understand why you're not answering our questions. You can't, when you were confirmed before the Armed Services Committee, you took an oath. Do you solemnly swear to give the committee the truth, the full truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? You answered yes to that.
And I've also answered that those conversations were classified, and it is not appropriate in an open forum to discuss those classified conversations.
What is classified about a conversation involving whether or not you should intervene in the FBI investigation?
Sir, I stand by my previous comments.
Mr. Coates, same series of questions. What's the basis for your refusal to answer these questions today?
The basis is what I've previously explained. I do not believe it is appropriate for me to...
What's the basis? I'm not satisfied with I do not believe it is appropriate or I do not feel I should answer. I want to understand a legal basis. You swore that oath to tell us the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and today you are refusing to do so. What is the legal basis for your refusal to testify to this committee?
I'm not sure I have a legal basis, but I'm more than willing to sit before this committee and during its investigative process in a closed session and answer your questions.
Well, we're going to be having a closed session in a few hours. Do you commit to me that you're going to answer these questions in a direct and unencumbered way?
Well, that closed session you're going to have in a few hours involves the staff going over the technicalities of a number of these issues and doesn't involve us. But
is it your testimony that you are before this committee in a closed session, you will answer these questions directly and unequivocally and without hesitation?
I plan to do that, but I do have to work through the legal counsel at the White House relative to whether or not they're going to exercise executive.
Admiral Rogers, will you answer these questions in a closed session?
I likewise respond as the DNI has. I certainly hope that that is what happens. I believe that's the appropriate thing. But I do have to acknowledge, because of the sensitive nature and the executive privilege aspects of this, I need to be talking to the general counsel in the White House. I hope we come to a position where we can have this dialogue. I welcome that dialogue, sir.
I hope so, too. And I would just add in conclusion that both of you testified you had never been pressured under 3 years. I would argue that you have waived executive privilege by, in effect, testifying as to something that didn't happen. And I believe you opened the door to these questions. And it is my belief that you are inappropriately refusing to answer these questions today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before I turn to Senator Lankford, let me say that the Vice Chairman and I have had conversations with Acting Attorney General Rosenstein when a special counsel was named. And as I had shared with the members of this committee prior to that as we carried out an investigation, there would come a point in time, either with an investigation that was currently ongoing at the FBI, or if there was a special counsel with the special counsel, where there would be avenues that this committee could not explore. And it was my hope that already the Vice Chair and I would have had that conversation with the special counsel. We have not. We've made the request. We intend to have it. And I think that both of us anticipated that we would reach this point at some point in the investigation. We are there where there are some things that will fall into the special counsel and or an active investigation, Vice Chairman.
Let me just say, though, that at this point, we've not had that conversation with Mr. Mueller. We've not been waived off on any subject. And the way I'm hearing all of you gentlemen is that Mr. Mueller has not waived you off from answering any of these questions. Is that correct?
I've had no conversations with Mr. Mueller. I've been out of the country
Have any of you had, because if you've not had questions waived off with Mr. Mueller, I think, frankly, and I understand your commitment to the administration, but that Senator King, Senator Heinrich, and my questions deserve answers, and at some point the American public deserves full answers.
I'm going to ask Mr. Rosenstein.
They don't care about full answers. They care about politics.
I'm sensitive to your desire to keep our answers brief, and my full answer actually would be very lengthy. But my brief answer, from my perspective with the Department of Justice, and I've been there for 27 years, and Mr. McCabe also is a career employee of the Department of Justice, our default position is that when there's a Justice Department investigation, we do not discuss it publicly. That's our default rule, so nobody needs to...
Is that the rule for the President of the United States as well?
I don't know what...
Because that is what the questions are being asked about, reports that nobody has laid the rest here, that the President of the United States has intervened directly in an ongoing FBI investigation, and we've gotten no answer from any of you, and frankly, we've at least heard from Director Coates and Admiral Rogers that they've not been asked to recuse an answer because of Director Mueller. And I don't understand why we can't get that in.
So I'm not answering for Director Rogers or Director Coates. I'm answering for Director McCabe and myself with regard to the Department of Justice.
Senator Langford.
Director McCabe, can I ask you, do you feel confident at this point the FBI is fully cooperating with Special Counsel for any requests in communication and setting up of the coordination between the offices for documents, work products, insight, anything the special counsel, as they're trying to get organized and get prepared for the investigations they're taking on, is everyone in the FBI fully cooperating with special counsel?
Absolutely, sir. I'm absolutely confident of that. We have a robust relationship with the special counsel's office, and we are supporting them with personnel and resources in any way they request.
Thank you. Admiral Rogers, this spring, NSA decided to stop doing about queries. That was a long conversation that's happened there. It's now come out in the public about that conversation, that was identified as a problem. The court agreed with that, and that has been stopped. What I need to ask you is, who first identified that as a problem?
The National Security Agency did.
Okay, so how did you report that? Reported that to who? How did that conversation go once you identified we're uncomfortable with this type?
So in 2016, I had directed our Office of Compliance, let's do a fundamental baseline review of compliance associated with 702.
Okay.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Senate Intelligence Committee as they have hearings with all the major intelligence, Department of Justice, you have Director of National Intelligence there, Mr. Coates. You have Admiral Rogers there, so you have everybody there. And I would tell you the headline of the story is both Rogers and Coates said that they've never been pressured by anybody at the White House to exert any influence on an investigation. Then the fishing expedition begins in terms of who said what. To me, and now we're getting to political points. So what did the president do? What did they say? Well, if they tell you it was that they don't feel that it was anything inappropriate, then we're going to mine for something that they can use on the news. So it's interesting. And I said, the Washington Post, their little headline that went out, said that Coates and Admiral Rogers, who's the director of the NSA, both refused to talk about the conversation. So, to me, the elephant in the room is obviously missed. So anyway, we're going to take a break. We're going to probably hang with this for a few more minutes, and then I've kind of tweaked the programming for today. And we'll listen to, great theater tomorrow as the former director of the FBI has to kind of, the director of the FBI will go ahead and, I forgot what I was going to say. I saw a headline, and it caught my attention. Anyway, we're going to take a break. But I do want to talk, in tweaking the programming, I want to share with you the Higher Calling audio. It's awesome. It's awesome stuff. And then beyond that, Phil Smith is going to join me at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to talk a little bit about Gettysburg. I've been asked a couple of different times, hey, I've heard you allude to Gettysburg. I'd be curious to hear a discussion about that. So I think what we'll do with Phil is kind of set the stage for the Gettysburg campaign And we'll see how far we get into that discussion. And we'll also talk a little bit about a little bit of military history, about the shaping, how the battle got shaped, and some interesting pieces of that. And I don't know that we could get through 3 days of it and the preamble. But we'll start. It's Phil Smith's a great reader of military history, and Gettysburg, one of my favorite battles as well. So we're going to take a quick break. The hearing is now. The Democratic senators are pissed because these intelligence chiefs do not want to talk about an open session what they believe to be privileged conversations between the President of the United States and them. And Senator, I think his name's Angus King, he took great exception with that. And essentially called them out, asked them if they would be candid and live up to their oath in private session. And they said, well, there's still, and to me, one of the news points of even the private session was the following. We are still navigating what the White House believes may be executive privilege. So maybe in the classified session, you will see the president these gentlemen claim executive privilege on those conversations. So interesting stuff going on. But honestly, the 702 part of the hearing seems to be concluded, and now we're mining for political points here. So interesting stuff. Hold on a second.
My first time at this, and I don't think there's a person up here that doesn't want to find out the facts and the truth and be able to go back home and explain to the Democrat and Republican colleagues, and no matter what political persuasion, that we have gotten the facts. We got it from our intel, which we truly appreciate and respect the quality of job and work that you do. And this is our findings. We're having a hard time getting there, as you can tell, and I respect where you all are coming from. I hope you could understand that sooner or later we're going to have to. There has to be one element of this government that the public can look at and said, this is not politically motivated. This is not a witch hunt. No one's trying to harm anybody. We just want to do the business of our government and our country and do the best that we can for that and make sure that they have the confidence in the people that they put at the head and have elected. That's what we're trying to get to. Today's been very difficult by me sitting here listening to some of the answers and an inability to answer some of the questions. If the Intelligence Committee in the Senate cannot get answers we know in an open setting like this, are these answers that we're asking, the questions that were simply asked today, would they be given into a classified intel setting that we would have? Could you answer differently than what you've given us an open session? I think, Director Coase, you said that you would be able to answer differently.
I think I've made that very clear.
Yes. Admiral Rogers, would you be able to?
And likewise, I certainly hope so.
Mr. Rosenstein, would you?
Senator, speaking for Mr. McCabe and myself, we have been involved in managing the criminal investigation, and so I would ask that you, as Chairman Baer suggested, it's really appropriate for Director Mueller, since we've turned over control of that investigation to him, to make the determination in the first instance about what we can and can't speak about. So I would encourage you to use Mr. Mueller as your point person as to whether or not it's appropriate to reveal that information.
Well, let's just say that the questions that was asked to Mr. McCabe, I think they weren't anything on the investigation side. It was asked pretty personal, directly. Could you answer differently in a classified setting, sir?
I would reiterate the DAG's comments that it's at this point, with the special counsel involved, it would be appropriate for the committee to have an understanding with the special counsel's office as to where those questions would go. But I would also point out that, as we have historically, when we are investigating sensitive matters in which operational security is of utmost importance, members of the intelligence community typically come and brief the leadership, congressional leadership, on sensitive investigative matters. We have done so. I have done so. Director Comey has done so prior to the appointment of the special counsel. And some of the questions that you have asked this morning were addressed in those closed, very restricted, very small settings.
Well, let me say this, that if it would be the desire of the chairman and vice chairman, if we could, since we have a classified hearing scheduled for 2 o'clock this afternoon, would you all make yourself available? Since it doesn't linger on, there's been a lot of questions, a lot of anticipation, a lot of build-up anxiety, if you will. I think you could really help an awful lot of us clear the day up, if you will.
If I could address the senator's question, this afternoon is set with technical people to walk us through 702. Rest assured that we will take the first available opportunity to have people back in closed session to address those questions that they can address. And hopefully prior to that, the vice chair and I would have an opportunity to meet with Director Mueller to determine whether that fits within the scope of his current investigation. And we will do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only thing I'm saying is that I know that you can tell by the intensity of the questions here that there's a lot of concerns right now, and we have both Director Coates and Admiral Rogers are willing to say in a classified hearing that they would be able to answer differently. That's the only reason I was bringing that up, and we had it this afternoon. I would hope that would maybe be considered. Let me ask a question. Does the President support Section 702 reauthorization of the FISA and expanded authority?
Absolutely.
Everyone?
Full support.
Full support there. Did the President ask, or was he given any...
It's interesting. You know, they the questions now surround what were their conversations with the President. In spite of what they said, they never felt any pressure. So, again, in terms of the political theater, in my opinion...
He and I have discussed as well the specifics.
When you look at them, so this hearing's about the FISA thing and 702, blah, blah, blah. But again, what it's devolved into is the Democrats need and they want to come out in open session, not in the classified session. Not that that'll make any difference because that'll surely get leaked. But they want it to come out in public session. And what's happened in this thing politically, right now, so we have the truth and then we have the ramifications of it. You have the Democrats sitting there with lemons. It looked like somebody stuffed a lemon up each one of their asses because they have not heard what they want to hear. And that is what they heard was, I've never felt pressured by the White House in any way, shape, or form to influence an investigation. Okay, so then the question was, well, what did he say? So, interesting theater.
You're going to skip sooner than later. Thank you.
Senator Cotton.
Thank you, gentlemen. I want to talk about the import of Section 702 to our national security.
Senator Cotton, former Army Infantry Officer.
Matter expert on the panel on signals intelligence from foreign threats, though I might turn to some of our lawyers for legal questions. Does Section 702, Admiral Rogers, allow you to collect information on U.S. citizens?
Is intentionally targeted individuals? No.
Intentionally target them?
No.
Does it allow you to target foreigners to do what's called reverse targeting of U.S. citizens, knowing those U.S. citizens are in communications?
No, it does not.
Does it allow you to collect information on foreigners who are on U.S. soil?
No.
It doesn't.
702 is outside the United States.
So you can collect information on an ISIS terrorist in Syria, and he comes to the United States, and you can no longer collect information on his cell phone or his email address.
We're in a foreign intelligence organization. We coordinate with the FBI, but yes, sir, we don't do internal domestic collection broadly.
Mr. Rosenstein, do foreigners have constitutional rights?
When they're in the United States, Senator, different rules apply, and that's why I think it's important for people to understand that Section 702 applies only in circumstances where it's a foreign national outside the United States. If they're inside the United States, we need to rely on other provisions of FISA to do that collection. So, yes, we can do it, but we need to apply different rules. And Mr. McCabe, as the director indicated, is responsible for that.
Mr. McCabe, what happens when an ISIS terrorist comes from Syria to the United States and Director Rogers or Admiral Rogers can no longer use Section 702 to monitor his electronic communications?
Yeah, Admiral Rogers' folks notify mine, and then we work together to pursue coverage under different elements of the FISA statute.
I'm sure you'd work as hard as you can to make sure that it's absolutely seamless, but it does seem to me that Section 702, because it's limited to foreigners on foreign soil without targeting any U.S. persons anywhere, goes the extra mile to protect the constitutional rights of American citizens and even the supposed constitutional rights of foreigners when they come on U.S. soil. That's one reason why I support the permanent extension of Section 702, and I introduced legislation to that effect yesterday with the support of all seven Republicans on this committee. Tom Bossert, the counterterrorism and Homeland Security Advisor to the President write in today's New York Times about our legislation. The Trump administration supports this bill without condition. Admiral Rogers, is that your position?
Could you repeat it again? I apologize, sir.
The Trump administration supports this bill without condition.
Yes.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how enthusiastic would you be if this bill passed? You can go over 10 and be excessively enthusiastic.
I would be ecstatic that we'd be in a position to continue to generate significant insights for this nation's security.
So you'd dial it straight up to 11?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Director Coates?
My level's about 100.
Mr. Rosenstein?
Senator, I'm not familiar with the rating system. I do think it's very important.
Director McCabe?
I'm at 11.
Director Coach, you had an exchange earlier with Senator Wyden about the efforts to estimate and declassify the number of persons who might be subject to incidental collection under Section 702. This is when you have a lawful 702 order, but someone does, in fact, communicate with an American citizen. It's my understanding that it would be virtually impossible to do so in a way that wouldn't further infringe on the rights of American citizens. Is that correct?
Well, that's, yes, and that's one of the central reasons why I came to the conclusion. But the main reason I came to the conclusion is that is just is not conceivably possible. We could go through the procedures. We could shift hundreds of people to go over and breach the rights of hundreds, if not thousands, of American citizens to determine whether or not they are American citizens or not. But we still, having done that, could not get to an accurate number, the number that Senator Wyden was trying to get us to. And I was, my pledge to him is I would go out there, try to fully understand why it was we couldn't get that. There'll be detailed discussions on that and the closed session with the staff and the technicians from both NSA and from Senate staff here and others relative to all of the efforts that have been made to try to answer the question. And as I said in my statement, even if we were to take people off their regular jobs and say, get on this issue, even if we could put other measures in place, we still would not be able to come up. It's hard to explain how difficult this is or why this is the case, but that is what is going to be discussed in the closed session because all this is classified information this afternoon. I assume the staff of members, all the members here will be there. But my pledge was to do the best I could to try to get to the to some answer. And the result was we couldn't get to an answer, number one. And number two, trying to get to an answer would totally disrupt the efforts of the agency. Now, if you know, you might be able to make the case, let's hire 1,000 more people and get to the answer if you knew that you would get to the answer. Admiral Rogers has told me, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, that if someone else out there knows how to get to it, he's welcome to have them come out and tell NSA how to do it. Well, but everybody says you can get to the number. It's easy. There's all kinds of agencies out there that can do it. I think you might welcome the advice if they wanted to do that. But it really raises the question of why there has to be an exact number.
Well, if we're going to hire 1,000 new people, I'd sooner them focus on terrorists and foreign intelligence services than violating the privacy rights of American citizens. My time has expired.
Senator Harris.
Thank you. Admiral Rogers, in response to the question from Senator Manchin, you, it appears, felt free to discuss the conversations you've had with the President in January about Russian active measures. Can you share with this committee how you're determining which conversations you can share and which you don't feel free to share?
Ma'am, the fact that we briefed the President previously, both went up to New York and previously, is a matter of public record.
So if it's a matter of public record, then you feel free to discuss those conversations?
If it's not classified. You can keep trying to trick me out. Senator, if you could I get to respond, please, ma'am?
No, sir. No.
Okay.
Are you saying that if it is classified, you will not discuss it? And
Senator Kamala Harris is a former prosecutor and attorney general from the state of California. She approaches these very much as a trial. You'll hear her. Closed and very narrow questions.
When you appointed a special counsel on May 17th, you stated, quote, based upon the unique circumstances, the public interest requires me to place this investigation under the authority of a person who exercises a degree of independence from the normal chain of command. The order you issued along with that statement provides that 28 CFR 600.4 through 10 were applicable. Those are otherwise known as the special counsel regulations. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator.
And it states that the special counsel, quote, shall not be subject to the day-to-day supervision of any official of the department. However, the regulations permit you, as acting attorney general for this matter, to override Director Mueller's investigative and prosecutorial decisions under specified circumstances. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator.
And it also provides that you may fire or remove Director Mueller under specified circumstances. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you indicated in your statement that you chose a person who exercises a degree of independence, not full independence, from the normal chain of command. So my question is this. In December of 2003, then-Attorney General John Ashcroft recused himself from the investigation into the leak that led to the disclosure of Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA officer. The acting Attorney General at the time was Jim Comey. He appointed a special counsel, Patrick Fitzgerald, to take over the matter. In a letter dated December 30th of 2003, Mr. Comey wrote the following to Mr. Fitzgerald, quote, I direct you to exercise the authority as special counsel independent of the supervision or control of any officer of the department. In a subsequent letter dated February 6, 2004, Mr. Comey wrote to clarify the earlier letter stating that his delegation of authority to Mr. Fitzgerald was, quote, plenary. Moreover, it said that my, quote, conferral on you of the title of special counsel in this matter should not be misunderstood to suggest that your position and authorities are defined or limited by 28 CFR Part 600. Those are the special counsel regulations we discussed. So, would you agree, Mr. Rosenstein, to provide a letter to Director Mueller, similarly, providing that Director Mueller has the authority as special counsel, quote, independent of the supervision or control of any officer of the department, and ensure that Director Mueller has the authority that is plenary and not, quote, defined or limited by the special counsel regulations?
Well, Senator, I'm very sensitive about time, and I'd like to have a very lengthy conversation and explain that all to you. I tried to do that.
Can you give me a yes or no answer?
In the closed briefing. Well, it's not a short answer, Senator. The answer
it is either you are willing to do that or not, as we have precedent in that regard.
But the Chairman, they should be allowed to answer the question.
It's a long question you pose, Senator, and I fully appreciate the import of your question, and I'll get to the answer. My quibble with you is Pat Fitzgerald is a very principled, very independent person. I have a lot of respect for him. Pat Fitzgerald could have been fired by the president because he was a United States attorney. Robert Mueller cannot because he's protected by those special counsel regulations. So although it's theoretically true that there are circumstances where he could be removed by the acting attorney general, which for this case at this time is me, your assurance of his independence is Robert Mueller's integrity and Andy McCabe's integrity and my integrity and those regulations.
Sir, if I may, the greater assurance is not that you and I believe in Director Mueller's integrity, which I have no question about Mr. Mueller's integrity. It is that you would put in writing an indication based on your authority as the acting attorney general that he has full independence in regards to the investigations that are before him. Are you willing or are you not willing to give him the authority to be fully independent of your ability statutorily and legally to fire him? Yes or no, sir?
He has the full independence as authorized by those regulations.
Are you willing to do as has been done before?
Would the senator suspend? The chair is going to exercise its right to allow the witnesses to answer the question, and the committee is on notice to provide the witnesses the courtesy, which has not been extended all the way across, extend the courtesy for questions to get answered.
Mr. Chairman, respectfully,
Mr. Rosenstein,
point out
you,
that this witness has joked with the, as we all have,
the senator
ability
will
defend. To filibuster.
Mr. Rosenstein, would you like to thoroughly answer
Thank
the question?
Thank you, Chairman. Senator, I'm not joking. The truth is, I have a lot of experience with these issues, and I could speak to you for a very long time about it. And I'm sympathetic. I appreciate the 5-minute limit. That's not my limit. But the answer is, this originated, as you may know, with the independent counsel statute. And I worked for an independent counsel, and I worked in the department during the independent counsel era, when independent counsels were appointed by authorization of the Senate. They were appointed by federal judges, and they had essentially the authority equivalent to the Attorney General. That statute sunsetted, and the majority of members of this body concluded that that was appropriate because they did not want special independent counsels who were 100% independent of the Department of Justice. That was a determination made by the legislature. Now, I know the folks at the department who drafted this regulation under Janet Reno, and they drafted it to deal with this type of circumstance. And the idea was that there would be some circumstances where, because of unusual events, it was appropriate to appoint somebody from outside the department, not somebody like Pat Fitzgerald, who as a U.S. attorney who could be fired, but somebody from outside the department who could be trusted to conduct this investigation independently and could be given an appropriate degree of independence. Under the regulation, he has, I believe, adequate authority to conduct this investigation. And your ultimate check, Senator, is, number one, the integrity of the people involved in the investigation, but number two, the fact that if he were overruled or if he were fired, we would be required under the regulation to report to the Congress. And so I believe that's an appropriate check. And so I realize that theoretically anybody could be fired, and so there's a potential for undermining an investigation. I am confident, Senator, that Director Mueller, Mr. McCabe, and I and anybody else who may fill those positions in the future will protect the integrity of that investigation. That's my commitment to you, and that's the guarantee that you and the American people have.
Senator Cornyn. Is that a no?
Senator Cornyn. Well, seems to be one thing we all agree on, at least so far based on the questions and the comments, and that is the 702 is an important tool for the intelligence community, and one that needs to be preserved, and I agree with Senator Cotton that it should be extended without a sunset provision as currently written. So it's good to have one thing we agree on. But I want to ask Director Coates and perhaps Admiral Rogers if you want to comment on this as well. As I understand,
you know, I've stayed with this too long because I find it interesting. The reason Senator McCain comes up, it's the next Republican, so we're gonna take a break, and I want to hear what Senator McCain has to say. So, with apologies for the ad hoc programming this morning, but the Senate Intel Committee is pretty interesting national security news, and it's one of the things we talk about on a regular basis. More of Armoring Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Interesting stuff, which starts about 36 hours probably of big news coming out of Washington, D.C. And if these comments are any indication of what will happen in the closed session, the bottom line is this. None of these intelligence chiefs felt any pressure from the White House. No matter what you read in the papers, which is not something that Democrats want to have come out. So you can see they're trying extremely hard to get some other headline out of this hearing than they're going to get. Now, the pathetic reality, though, is this. They'll go into closed session. What would you bet the testimony from the closed session is in your local is on the news tonight or in your local newspaper tomorrow morning? What would you bet? Film at 11. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com and with the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We are, I want to hear Senator McCain today. And he is, there's another questioner, and then Phil Smith's going to join us, and I want to talk about Gettysburg. Senator Reid is the ranking Democrat.
I'm trying to understand the rationale for...
So we're going to hear more about the rationale behind them not wanting to discuss conversations with the president.
With Mr. Mueller. You've had those conversations?
Yes, sir.
You're fully familiar with the scope of the investigation, since you've dealt with not only Mr. Mueller, but also with...
I am, sir, but I think it's important to note that Mr. Mueller and his team are currently in the process of determining what that scope is. And much in the way that Senator Cornyn just referred to, the FBI maintains a much broader responsibility to continue investigating issues relative to potential Russian counterintelligence activity and threats posed to us from our Russian adversaries. So determining exactly where those lanes in the road are, where does Director Mueller's scope overlap into our pre-existing and long-running Russian responsibilities is somewhat of a challenge at the moment, and that is why I'm trying to be particularly respectful of his efforts and not to take any steps that might compromise his investigation.
But getting back to your rationale for not commenting on the conversation between you and Mr. Comey, there's it seems to me that what you said is that there either that is part of a criminal investigation or likely to become part of a criminal investigation, the conversation between the President of the United States and Mr. Comey, and therefore you cannot properly comment on that. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, sir.
What about the conversations between Director Coates and Admiral Rogers with the President of the United States? Is that likely to become or is part of a ongoing criminal investigation?
I couldn't comment on that, sir. I'm not familiar with that, and it wouldn't be, for the same reasons it's not appropriate for me to comment on Director Comey's conversations, I certainly wouldn't comment on those that I'm further away from.
Mr. Rosenstein, are you aware of the possibility of an investigation, the conversations that Director Coates and Admiral Rogers have had with the President?
My familiarity with that, Senator, is limited to what I read in the newspaper this morning and what we heard here today.
Okay. Director Coates, have you had any contact with the special prosecutor or any...
I have not.
Have you been advised by any of your counsels, or private or public, that this conversation that you have with the President could be subject to a criminal investigation?
I have not.
Admiral Rogers, same question.
For the last question, no, I have not.
Yeah. Let me just return again to the points that I think Senator King made very well, which is this unwillingness to comment on the conversation with the President, but to characterize it in a way that you didn't feel pressured, yet refusing to answer very specific and non-intelligence-related issue. I don't see how it would impact on the classification and our status, whether or not you were specifically asked by the President to do anything. Do you still maintain that you can't comment on whether you're asked or not?
Nothing has changed since my initial response.
I stand by my previous answer.
I just must say that the impression I have is that if you could say that, you would say that. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Senator McCain.
Well, gentlemen, you're here at an interesting time. It's funny how sometimes events run together. This morning's Washington Post. Top intelligence official told associates Trump asked him if he could intervene with Comey on FBI Russia probe. It goes into some detail. I'm sure you've read the article, and it's more than disturbing, obviously, if it's true that the President of the United States was trying to get the Director of National Intelligence and others to abandon a investigation into Russian involvement, it's pretty serious. I also understand the position that you're in, because it is classified information, and yet here it is on this morning's Washington Post in some detail. I'm sure you've read it. So I guess if I understand you right, Director Coates, is that in a closed session you are more than ready to discuss this situation. Is that correct?
I would hope we'd have the opportunity to do that.
Well, I hope we can provide you with that opportunity. You know, it's just shows what kind of an Orwellian existence that we live in. I mean, it's detailed, as you know from reading the story, as to when you met, what you discussed, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, here in a public hearing before the American people, we can't talk about what was described in detail in this morning's Washington Post. Do you want to comment on that, Dan?
Are you asking me? Comment on the integrity of the Washington Post reporting? I guess I've been around town.
It's pretty detailed.
I guess I've been around town long enough to say, not take everything at face value that's printed in the Post. I served on the committee here and often saw that the information that we had been discussed had been reported, but that wasn't always accurate. I think this is the response that I gave to the Post was that I did not want to publicly share what I thought were private conversations with the President of the United States. Most of them, almost all of them, intelligence-related and classified. I didn't think it was appropriate to do so in an open for the Post to report what it reported or do that in an open session.
Well, it's an unfortunate situation that you're sitting there because it's classified information, and this morning's Washington Post describes in some detail, not just outline, but times and dates and subjects that are being discussed. And I'm certainly not blaming you, but it certainly is an interesting town in which we exist.
And just because it's published in the Washington Post doesn't mean it's now unclassified.
But unfortunately, whether it's classified or not, it's now out to the world, which is obviously not your fault, but describes dates and times and who met with who. And do you want to tell us any more about the Russian involvement in our election that we don't already know from reading the Washington Post?
I don't think that's a position that I'm in. I do know that there are ongoing investigations. I do know that we continue to provide all the relevant intelligence we have to enable those investigations to be carried out with integrity and with knowledge.
Well, it must be a bit frustrating to you in protecting what is clearly sensitive information and to read all about it in the Washington Post. You have my sympathy, and I express that at your confirmation hearing, doubting your sanity. So, Admiral, you got anything to say about it?
No, sir, other than, boy, some days I sure wish I was an ensign on the bridge of that destroyer again.
I can understand that. I feel the same way. Mr. Rosenstein.
Senator, I can't speak for anybody else, but I am proud to be here. I'm proud to be here with Director McCabe, and I'm sure he feels the same way.
I do.
Whatever that might mean. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator McCain. The chair is going to recognize Senator Wyden for one question on 702.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the courtesy. This one...
All right. Heard enough of that. All right. Interesting stuff, though. The Washington Post... if you go to it this morning, it's a pretty interesting little endeavor there. And the Director of National Intelligence, in detail, and that's what Senator McCain was talking about, in detail. Talks about Coates told associates Trump asked him if he could intervene with Comey in the Russia probe. Okay, now this is the game of politics, right? And for the narrative. So the article. And it's amazing, right? Here's the Director of National Intelligence's conversations, okay, in the Washington Post. And so, anyway, what's being said is, is by the director himself that he didn't feel pressured by the president, okay? And so the insinuation is, if there was any discussion that took place, somehow or other. Now, maybe that's appropriate in terms of, I just go back to my participation in different investigations. And normally, as somebody was getting investigated, whoever they knew that had credibility, I think contacted people in the investigation and said, hey, you know, I'd be happy to be interviewed, just so you know, blah, 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 blah. And they, quote unquote, went to bat for their guy or their girl in the who was being investigated. So, I don't know. Again, it's this unholy political thing that we have going on both sides of the aisle that is playing out here today. And I don't know that the narrative of the truth is important anymore in this country. It's extremely pathetic to me that it's not the narrative of the truth. It is the narrative of whatever party can broadcast their message. And to do what? To further the cause of democracy? No. It's to further the cause of their party. And I think it's political. And again, it's what we see. It's what we're used to. They don't get it. It's what got Donald Trump elected in the first place, is the dissatisfaction of not conservatives, because that's not what elected him, right? Of the majority of the undecideds, that 35% of people that elect the president every year that sit in the middle and fall one way or the other. They voted for Donald Trump and change and an outsider in spite of everything that he said and did. So anyway, we'll take a quick break. Phil Smith will join us next. We'll talk a little bit about Gettysburg. Again, I apologize for the impromptu ad-libbing of the schedule today, but interesting stuff in Washington, D.C. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts with 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set.
Hey,
perfect
an
for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, BattleMug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.